That's Ruat Saladin. I will arise and go to Jesus. It is 12 minutes after the hour. It's a Tuesday morning, and we weren't sure we were going to have him today. In fact, we weren't sure that he wasn't rotting in some dungeon. And see, we have this preconceived notions of what life in Cuba is like. We're about to get the straight scoop from Dr. Don Clark, who's a member of the Board of Creation Moments, a biochemist, and a recent returnee. 1:30 Sunday morning he got back, eh?
1:30 in the morning, yes, yeah. Indeed.
Okay.
I can't say bright and early because it wasn't bright. It mm-hmm. was dark and late.
And I'll bet that was it an exhausting trip? You were there for what, a week and a half, something like that?
2 weeks.
2 weeks, okay.
Almost 2 weeks.
2 weeks in yep. Cuba.
Almost 2 weeks. Had we stayed another day, it would have been 2 weeks.
Yeah, but. Now this was not purely, this wasn't as a tourist. You went with a mission in mind. How is it you came to get to Cuba? Who decided you were going to Cuba, and did you need special permission, or how was it that came to be?
Yes, I went with a group called Heaven's Family, and I know the individuals, two folks from our church, Bob and Carol Collins, are with Heaven's Family, and Bob mm-hmm. does prison ministry, and he's the one I do Malachi Dads with here in Texas, in one of the Texas prisons. And we had an opportunity to teach at two pastors' conferences pastors' chaplains' conferences in Cuba. So the chaplains are already going into to the prisons or ministering to the families of inmates. And so this was a trip to help equip them better for prison ministry. And we brought the directors from Awana Lifeline, mm-hmm. who are promoting the Malachi Dads program, actually globally around the world, but that's the same program, like I said, that we do in the prison here in Texas. And so they presented their materials, and then each of us did some teaching on various topics of mm-hmm. Restoration.
But how is it that a communist government would allow Christian ministries in? I mean, they're philosophically diametrically opposed, aren't they?
It is, and there is a state church. The churches that we visited were not state churches. They were actually Assembly of God churches.
Underground or above ground?
They're semi above ground. Now, mm-hmm. they have been persecuted for 55 years, mm-hmm. and it's only been recently that this has even been possible. And so we went in with a religious visa, with religious visas, and our contact in Cuba actually had to apply for those visas in Cuba. And he didn't know whether they were going to be accepted or not until almost the last minute mm-hmm. when he actually got the visas. So we had all of our plans, of course, and we were on our way down to Cuba. And it was kind of nip and tuck as to whether or not we would be able to get into the country. But we had absolutely no problem.
Do you suppose that the president's recent visit had anything to do with that, and his entourage and all the arrangements for that? Did that maybe open some doors for you?
It's hard to know. Possibly there is there's certainly a move to get more commerce into Cuba, and of course the United States embargo has more than anything hurt the Cuban people.
That's what embargoes do. Yeah,
the Cuban government.
Don't think Raul has missed a meal, probably.
Yeah, I don't know. I don't think so, because they. It's interesting because the government controls all of the beef in the country. So every cow that you see grazing, in a field belongs to the government, and the people cannot have beef. They can have pork, and they can have chicken and fish, but beef is reserved for government officials.
That's amazing.
It is quite amazing. And there's absolutely no incentive for a farmer to raise beef, because apparently there's quite a bit of penalties. If something happens to one of your cows, then you're interrogated as to, you know, what happened to it.
Government property here, yeah.
Did you sell it on the black market? You know, how did it die? And all this other stuff. So it would seem to me that there would be no reason for a farmer to raise cattle other than being forced to, you know, by mm-hmm. the government.
Were you able to visit outside the cities? Were you, these churches then in what we would call rural areas or out in the countryside?
Well, we flew into Holkeen, which is kind of in the middle of the island, and a smaller town than Havana, but still a fairly big town. Then we drove from there down to a little city on the coast, the southern coast, called Baracoa. And that's where we held our first pastors' conference, and that was in a small church, and wood frame, you know, structure. Obviously, a much poorer, you know, neighborhood or community. It actually is one of the vacation spots in Cuba, because it's right there on the coast and right there. Right there on the beach, and they have beautiful, clear rivers that ultimately flow into the ocean, and beautiful, clear water, you know, around there. But that trip from Holkeen to Baracoa was an grueling eight-hour trip.
Hmm.
Mainly because the roads were bad and you couldn't really travel fast. It wasn't that the distances was necessarily that far. I mean, we could have traveled it here in this country probably in an hour and a half or 2 hours. Mm-hmm. But, you know, it took much, much longer, because at times we were slowing down almost to a stop to get around the potholes in the roads.
Now, Baracoa is on the eastern tip of the island over there, close to Guantanamo.
Mm-hmm.
Did you get to Guantanamo at all?
We passed near it on our way back.
Okay.
But we didn't go into Guantanamo as such. But we did see a lot of the scenery of Cuba. We pretty much traversed the whole island during the trip, spending hours in the two vans that we were in. But both of the chaplains' conferences were extremely well received. The information that we were presenting, materials that we were presenting, were pretty much eaten up by the chaplains. They were so grateful that we had come, because the information and the resources that they have is very, very limited, you know, as you can imagine.
How many of them were there at the pastors' conference? Six? 50? 100?
No, there were probably about 70 in Baracoa, mm-hmm. and then about 80 or so at the other location.
So these would have been 70 to 80 individual churches represented, do you think?
Multiple churches represented from around the area, and some people traveled for hours to get to the conference. And some people walked to the conference, so, mm-hmm. You know, and walked great distances. Transportation is a problem. Not many people own automobiles. Interesting things are the 1950 cars. Hmm. About half, it looked like half the vehicles are 1950 cars.
Mm-hmm.
That have been not necessarily restored, but just maintained, kept running. You know, obviously painted over, but in fairly good shape, and some of them actually quite beautiful.
Mm-hmm.
And those, so you had those, and then you had some, you know, some modern cars, but not too many. And of course, you could see some Russian tractors and various, you know, the influence of Russia here or there. But the people are just unbelievably welcoming and loving, at least the people in the church. The Holy Spirit was moving mightily. We had after the teachings, we had 3-day conference. So after the teachings, we had 2 church services, and in both services, it was a celebration of joy and a celebration of love, and you know, people got healed. The people got healed in the conferences when we prayed. Prayed for healing. I mean, the Holy Spirit was just moving mightily, and it reminded me. I'm doing a study, you know, now in Revelation with our church. I'm teaching Revelation, and it certainly reminded me of the church at Smyrna, which is the persecuted church, and this church has been persecuted for 55 years. And been put down for 55 years, and it's only, like I said, probably since 2012 that things have begun to lighten up a bit. It wasn't until 2012 that even, you know, people couldn't even own property, and now people can own some property, so some commerce is even within the country. Is beginning to come back in, which is a good thing. Canada, interestingly enough, did not embargo Cuba, and so a lot of Canadians have gone to Cuba on vacations, and Baracoa is one of the locations that they go to. So there are, there's a hotel there. We didn't stay in a hotel, but we stayed in these bed and breakfasts. And these are basically houses that the owners have fixed up, maybe a room or two for guests and for visitors. And they take them into their house you have a room and some, you know, most of the time there's a bathroom.
hostels, we used to call them. They were common in Europe.
Yeah, they're hostels. Mm-hmm. Very, very much like that. And so those are beginning to pop up more and more, you know, around Cuba. And that's basically where we stayed the whole trip. But we've in the various towns that we went to. Some of them were better than others, but it by no means was uncomfortable. I mean, even the the poorest hostel, if you will, was still very, very clean, and you still had running water, and there was still a bathroom. It was an interesting place. It was almost as if time stopped in the 50s. And now it's beginning to pick back up. One of the interesting things is that we all felt that the church, the free church, not the free church, but not the state church, but the more Pentecostal church, for example, is on the cusp of a great revival in Cuba. And it wouldn't surprise me if in the years, the short years to come, that there is a tremendous revival in Cuba because of all of the pent-up pressure, if you will, from the persecuted church and not being able to have church or being an underground church is now, that is being released and... The church or the churches that we visited, they really have a heart for the Cuban people. They have a heart for the downcast and the trodden and the imprisoned, and making every effort, even though the government is stopping a lot of the effort, you know, like I said, to go into the prisons to evangelize, to teach, to help bring restoration, you know, to the captives, if you will. And it was like I was reading Revelation right here in my in front of my eyes. I mean, it was just an awesome experience.
Not to mention the Sermon on the Mount.
Yeah, exactly.
Is there hope there? I mean, beyond the church.
Oh yeah, there's a lot of hope. They are very, very hopeful. They see that the government will probably relax even more as time goes on, and if this relationship between the United States and Cuba opens up, that's going to open up many opportunities for a lot of people. And on our return, we wound up in Havana, which is on the other side of the island. Another very, very long trip from Baracoa to Santa Clara, where near that we had another pastor's conference, and then from Santa Clara we drove to Havana. I mean, these are eight hour drives. Mm-hmm. A lot of driving. But when we got to Havana, and we spent the night, and then the next day we kind of toured around Havana a little bit, and we were brought to the kind of the center of the city and the government buildings and everything, and our contact, who's the national director for prison ministry, said, "You see these buildings? All these buildings around here, there is not one new building. The government has not built one new building over the 55-year period. They basically just squandered the money and didn't do anything for the people." You could see that a lot of the places where you went, a lot of beautiful old buildings, but in desperately need of repair. Mm-hmm. Some of them crumbling, some of them, you know, the walls kind of separating. But you could see at one point in time that a lot of workmanship had gone into some of these buildings.
So, and I don't know if you've been able to digest all this yet. I mean, you just got back. It was only 2 weeks, and your exposure was primarily to the church there. But what's your impression of this idea of embargo? Was it a huge mistake? Does it solve problems or cause problems?
That's a really tough.
That isolation is never an answer.
Yeah, I think, you know, it obviously hurt the people more than the government. However, it probably allowed the people to feel, if you will, the failure of the system more than they might have had we continued to.
Well, isn't that the thinking behind embargo, though? It's to starve out the government eventually, and to incentivize the people, the grassroots, to get rid of the oppression, but that it would take 50 or 60 years, to me, proves it the opposite. I mean, you don't wait 50 or 60 years for this.
Well, exactly, and the people aren't going to, I didn't see any evidence of rebelling against the government. While I was there, of course, you know, people are very cautious. But whether or not embargoes works, I mean, the government's still the same government. Mm-hmm. We've had, you know, 55 plus years of embargo against Cuba. Is the government going to change? Well, the government has to change. I mean, at least some aspects of the government has to change. So otherwise, the country is just going to starve to death.
See, this does not sound to me like a situation where the senior government leaders, Castro and his family and the other people who were participants in the revolution and have governed the island since, that they're the kind of people that would pass on a legacy of oppression to the next generation. You know, are there junior lieutenants coming up who are going to maintain the same policies, or are they all sick of it?
Well, we didn't really get into that, quite frankly, because we were told that, stay away from the political discussions.
Sure. Yeah, I can see that, yeah.
One, because your neighbor could be listening and actually report you, is the primary reason. Now, we did have time where we were in an isolated van and nobody was listening except, you know, the people in the van. And we did have some discussions, but they really don't, I don't think they really know what's going to happen after this, other than there is great hope that things will change and loosen up. And I think they will loosen up. How much will they loosen up? I don't know. 10 years from now, will Cuba look more like like Europe with its socialistic system? Probably. Will it remain a communist, closed, communist system? They're too small. I don't think they could survive. They've got to trade. They've got mangoes are everywhere on that island. I mean, fruit is everywhere on that island, like most, Central American countries. They've got sugarcane. They've got the ability, a lot of land to do some major farming with. They've got the ability to provide a lot of fresh fruits, papayas, pineapples, mangoes, guavas. We've had guava juice just about every morning. We had papayas just about every meal, as well as pineapple juice. I mean, so fresh fruits are abundant. Mm-hmm. Bananas, it's just that tropical, the tropical climate where you stick something in the ground, it's going to grow. And it's quite fertile land from what I saw. Mm-hmm. So they have the ability to really make a go of it economically if the doors are open for them, to trade.
Of course, at one time it was a flourishing place, a flourishing economy. David, I know you've got a question. I didn't mean to step in front of you there. So.
Well, and it's kind of I'm kind of getting the answers to my questions as we go along. I remember from Malawi, we didn't really talk about the politics of the situation all that much because there wasn't really all that much that the people could do. It's much more freer, much more looser of an economy than Cuba's is. I'm wondering if there was any talk about when the Castros die. Raul has got to be in his 70s, maybe 80s, and Fidel has been in and out of the hospital and is got to be in his 80s or 90s. And I'm looking at the Wikipedia page, and there's, of course, there's this huge, great, big, giant governmental system behind them. I would think it's not, certainly not the majority. Yeah, Raul is 84, and I think he's the kid.
He's definitely the younger.
He's the younger of the two. So, I mean, these guys can't live forever. What happens when they no longer are around? And I'm not sure. It's very difficult for, and like where it's like we're seeing with the Soviet Union, where it's very difficult for people to suddenly just gravitate towards democracy and freedom and free markets overnight. I mean, it's a very challenging thing to do.
Well, I think it definitely will be a process, and depending on who steps up, after the Castros, will determine which way the country goes. Now, I didn't see any indication that they were going to go Democratic.
Well, there'd be a large bureaucracy in place, I would figure. A lot of people making their living off the people are going to want to continue to do that.
Well, we were told that at least 10% of the population is in government. Mm-hmm. You know, which doesn't sound like a whole lot, but I mean, 10% of the population is is a lot of people. I mean, you know, you're talking about, I think the population was 22 million total on the island. So not a huge population, but so, you know, having a million or two in the government's a lot of folks. But there a lot of reason why they're in government is because there are no other jobs. I mean, the other interesting thing was that the medical community is doing well. They have a lot of medical training facilities, and apparently their medical standards are quite high. But when it comes to technology, there are no technical schools, for example, no computer schools that we were told existed, or other types of technologies. So that would be one area that they need to build up in. But it wouldn't surprise me when the doors open that the people from the States are going to go down to Cuba to have their operations
a lot of stuff could be imported, including technology, once the society opens up. Did you see young people?
Yes. There are a lot of young people, in society, in Cuba now. Like any society, there's a drug problem and there's a alcohol problem, and unfortunately, some of the young folks are getting involved with that. But the church is everywhere. I mean, even if it's just in a house. I mean, one of the houses I stayed in Havana, the host or the owner said, "Okay, you know, you can sleep here tonight. I need to go back to my prayer meeting." The prayer meeting was in another room in the same house, right where I was. And it was just wonderful to hear the praise and worship music, and hear them singing, and hear them, you know, the preaching. Of course, I couldn't understand a lot of what they were saying, but they were thanking God an awful lot. And the community, although around them was extremely, extremely poor, people were joyful and people were hopeful. And so, and they're in the midst of the poverty, and they're in the midst of communities, and they're reaching out to people. And, the love of Christ is just overflowing. And that is going to have a major, major impact, on that country, and will transform it from the inside, out. It doesn't take America to, establish a democratic, society, or a republic society, but they will do what they're going to do naturally from the inside as the Lord moves in that country.
Well, it sure seems to be that through the grand sweep of history, in areas and in eras where there's been great oppression of people, they turn to God. And the church, under times of persecution, has flourished off and on through history all around the world. And I think maybe it's that very, very oppression that the church feels in Cuba that is helping them to thrive, because the government can't provide real answers.
Well, the government can't provide answers. The society that they're living in can't hardly provide them with a living. Mm-hmm. And people are coming together and acting like the church. and they are relying on God, and their livelihood and their sustenance is coming, from a spiritual direction as opposed from a materialistic direction, and the people are happy and joyous, are doing amazing things. Amazing things. We went to this couple that I stayed in one of their houses. They were amazing people. I mean, the love of God on them was overwhelming, and they were just joyous. The husband, the man, was an alcoholic. And he was educated. He was in business, and then got into alcoholism, lost everything, but was witnessed to and received Christ. His life was turned around, and he's got a street ministry right there in his neighborhood. They take in alcoholics and people off the street because. In order to find a job, you have to have an address. And so if you're on the street, you don't have an address, you can't get an identification card, and you can't work. And so you're in a desperate situation. There's no way you can get out of that unless somebody helps you. And these folks are taking these people in and rehabilitating them and giving them a place to stay, giving them address, training them with skills, and then sending them out as they are able and ready to go back out in the world as a transformed individual. They are truly doing restoration and transformation on a person by person basis. It's just amazing.
Terrific story, Dr. Don Clark, just returned from 2 weeks in Cuba, along with an American mission team, and speaking to pastors and to churches in that island nation. Don, I suggest we're out of time for global warming. Maybe we can tackle that next week. But this has been fascinating.
Well, yeah, that'll be fine. It's just another article. ICR just has a new article about global warming on their website, which is interesting, and we can definitely pick that up. Next time. But Cuba is alive and well. The people are, like I said, on the church and is on the cusp of, a great revival. It would not surprise me if Cuba starts sending out when they're allowed to. A lot of people can't even leave Cuba, at least legally, yet. But when they are allowed to, will evangelize other countries from Cuba. In other words, Cuba might indeed, and looks like they probably will, become a missionary nation, a nation that sends out missionaries like we were. Who knows, they might even send them to the States to evangelize us again.
One of the things that happened to me when we came back 2 years ago, and I still talk about it. I still have the deep, deep feelings. And maybe it's too early for you yet, that you haven't been back long enough. But right now, what are your first thoughts about the trip, the reflection, beyond the incredible gratitude that you've got to feel when you land in an airport and you walk in and the electric doors open and you have electric lights and you turn the light on with a switch? And what kinds of feelings do you have right now?
I would probably go back to Cuba in a heartbeat.
Yeah.
The harsh conditions, after a while, I mean, 2 weeks was a long time. And I got to admit that, by Saturday, by the time we were getting ready to leave, I was ready to leave, ready to come back. And but that's, you know, that's just the comforts of life. I mean, it's really, those people don't have that opportunity. But I would go back in a heartbeat just because the love of the people are just overwhelming. I mean, it's just overwhelming.
Okay.
And that trumps any conveniences that we might have here.
Don, great story. Appreciate hearing about your experience in Cuba. We'll look forward to next week. And in the meantime, rest up, get unpacked. And I'm sure some more stories will pop to the surface, too, as you get to ruminate on your experience. Dr. Don Clark, member of the Board of Creation Moments, their website, creationmoments.com. Lots of good things to discover there. You can link to it from our website on Broken Road Radio. Don, have a great week. We'll see you.
Okay, very good. You have a great week as well.
See you next week, Don.